This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, we'll summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which many episodes I will select at random. Any book from my comic book collection is eligible as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 70th episode of the Quarterbin Podcast, we're looking at Watson and Holmes number 1 from New Paradigm Studios, cover dated July 2013. And by we, I don't mean just me and my framed Mike Grill prints. Thanks, Sutherlands! No, for this episode, we means me and another podcasting veteran, a fellow Holmesian, a wizard, a true star, the heart and soul and good look, the heart and soul of the Dinner for Geeks podcast, Megalopolis, Mr. Ron, just Ron Sadowski.
Hey, Professor.
Glad to have you here, Ron.
I'm glad to be here. It's nice to be someplace where I'm the secondary concern after the food.
There you go. If it helps, do you want me to add just a little restaurant background? Maybe have a waitress stop by every 5-10 minutes, see how you're doing, or whatever's going to make you feel comfortable.
I'm just not going to be comfortable no matter what.
Now, you are here because my impression is that you are a fan of the man from Baker Street.
Sherlock Holmes, yeah.
That's the one.
Yeah. A fan? I don't know if fan's the right word. I've been thinking about this since you asked me to come on and speak about this issue, and I can't remember when I first was exposed to Sherlock Holmes. It's one of those things that just has always been in the ether. I don't know, just like it's like an arm. It's always been a Sherlock Holmes in my life.
So I think we can start right there with our Sherlock Holmes origin stories, and you maybe don't really have one, but I'll tell you mine.
Please.
And that's that my mom was a huge reader and a frequent visitor to public libraries. I'm a big reader mainly because she was. But she was especially a fan of mystery novels. So by the time I'm 10 or so, I'd read a couple, Agatha Christie's, as well as more kid-friendly fare like the great Encyclopedia Brown. And at some point around those age, I picked up one of the Doyle short story collections. And I think my mom was smart enough to figure out I didn't have the attention span for the novels. And a couple of them get pretty dry in the middle. But stories I specifically remember enjoying early on in life are the Red-Headed League and the Speckled Band.
Oh, yeah.
And then sometimes when I'm maybe 15 or so, my parents gave me for my birthday or Christmas a one-volume, complete Sherlock Holmes with all the stories and all four novels. And I still own that and have been a huge fan of Sherlock ever since. So I think similar to you, there's really never been a time when mysteries in general, mystery novels, mystery stories weren't part of sort of the everyday surroundings.
I understand that completely. But, and the funny thing is, in trying to figure out what my origin was, you sort of look back and I'm like, now, I'll be honest. The canon Sherlock Holmes by Arthur Conan Doyle stuff, I've actually just finished reading the first book last year. There's a funny thing in my life. I managed to get through high school without ever reading any of the required books, though I was able to pass all the tests. Once I got later in my life, I'm like, I probably should actually read these books that I seem to know about. And I have, like you, I have a nice big bound volume of all the Sherlock Holmes stories, which I thought, this would be great. I got this big volume. Unfortunately, it's not conducive to take with me, and the only time I read is when I'm going someplace else.
Right.
So I happen to have a pocketbook copy of the Adventures of Sherlock Holmes.
Nice.
I read the Study in Scarlet, Sign of the Four, and Adventure Sherlock Holmes last year. And I'm saying, so where did my Sherlock Holmes come from? Because it's not like we sat around the house and, you know, smoked pipes and were disc talkers. So I thought, you know what? I was a comic book reader. Time I could read, I was reading comic books because I had a brother who was 7 years older than me, so he was already into them. And when I couldn't read, he had to read them to me. And then once I learned to read, I read them myself. And so he would buy comic books every week. I'd read whatever he bought. And then eventually at some point, I started buying my own. I went back to my comic book collection. I only have one comic book with Sherlock Holmes in it. And that is Detective Comics 627. And that's the Batman anniversary issue. And I'm like, that can't possibly be right. So I started researching online. I'm like, I must have read maybe the Sherlock Holmes, because I don't buy Marvel as a going concern. Maybe there was a Marvel series. Maybe there was a Gold Key series that I didn't collect, but I read when I was a kid. It turns out Sherlock Holmes in comic books is almost non-existent.
Yeah, right.
And it wasn't until we get into the 90s and Malibu with their
right.
Eternity line started actually doing Sherlock Holmes, doing stuff like the reprints of the 1950s comic strip. They adapted all the classic stories. Right now, I know the last time I was in a bookstore, they had a comic adaptation, a serialized comic adaptation of the 7% Solution.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That's going
interesting.
Out. Yeah, so if you're a Holmesian, this is the time.
Oh, absolutely. The last decade has definitely been the time.
I am a bit perplexed by my enjoyment of Sherlock Holmes because I really can't figure out where I was into it. But it's one of those things that I cannot deny.
Now, in a world that would have Batman and Sherlock Holmes, who's the world's greatest detective?
Sherlock Holmes is.
Absolutely.
Because he's not distracted by some kid running around.
Watson sometimes acts like one, but not. It's a totally different thing.
Yeah, all he has to do is go, hey, Watson, pretty girl. And Watson's gone.
So how do you feel about adaptations or expansions of the Holmes canon? For an example, I'm a big fan of Laurie R. King's series of novels featuring the character of Mary Russell and a retired Holmes. About 12 novels, I think, in that series. Been a few clunkers, but for the most part, I've really enjoyed them. How about any, again, extensions or expansions beyond the originals that you like? Sort of sticking to books
first. At first. It's one of those things. Iconic character, and a bunch of people like to do it. And you get good and you get bad. And and when it's good, you're like, oh, this is awesome. And when it's bad, you're like, oh, come on, really? I will say I'm right now in the process of reading Tom Sawyer. It took me a long time to get around to reading it because I at one point read Double Barrel Detective Stories, which is Mark Twain's attempt to do a Sherlock Holmes story. Matter of fact, actually has Sherlock Holmes in it. And, of course, points out that Sherlock Holmes is an idiot. And it's kind of off-putting. But when it's done good or done better, A Slight Trick of the Mind, which came out about, I don't know, a half dozen years ago, and they adapted into the film Mr. Holmes, was an interesting take on the older Holmes, retired, looking back on his life, and trying to realize, you know, what he missed and how he can adjust for it. You know, and so, yeah, I actually enjoy when other people try. Mm-hmm. And there is something to be said about the canon.
How about TV and movies, which has been a place that's, again, sort of been a Holmesian renaissance the last decade or so, although for me, discussions of Holden's adaptations begins with The Great Mouse Detective.
Oh, really? Oh, I watched that a couple years ago, and I was just like, it has Vincent Price in it. It's a Disney film, and it still put me to sleep.
Oh, I tell you. Ron.
I'm sorry.
Do you have Scott Rifen's number? I mean, just if we could, and we could just seamlessly move. Okay, well, how about either Robert Downey Jr. at the movie house, or Sherlock, or Elementary, or anything like that?
Most of that stuff is really good. I'm caught up on the. Actually, I haven't watched the last season of Sherlock yet. I gotta get that. Sorry. Thank you. Let me write a note. It's so hard now when, you know, there is no prime time and this.
Right.
It's like something's coming out and you don't think about it. And the next 6 months later, it's like, it's out on video now. It's like, what? I've got the entire run of the 1950 Sherlock Holmes TV series.
Oh, nice.
And that is just crisp half hour, you know, get in. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, you know, they're not going to have time to do any Holmes development. You know, there's not going to be any. But they did a good, you know, just a little bit of that stuff every episode so that you got that Holmesian feel.
Right.
You know, and I think that's important. Mysteries come and go, but, you know, Holmes and Watson are always together.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And then, of course, the big budget movies, I think I've seen pretty much most of them, and they vary.
Yes.
Robert Downey Jr., Sherlock Holmes, I mean, that it's enjoyable, it's fun. It's
not really Holmes, but it's fun for what it is.
Yeah, you know, I enjoy most of it. I have not seen Elementary. I know a lot of people are up on that.
Yeah, I haven't watched that one either.
And it's too much. There's too much right. Holmes right now.
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that.
I enjoyed, you know, the Basil Rathbone series and. And every now and then, you know, they'll come out and they'll go, oh, we just found another copy. We just found an actual copy of, you know, Sherlock Holmes that was done in 1933 by always. It always seems like there's something more.
I'm a big fan of the Jeremy Brett series from the 80s and 90s. They ran they're British and then ran on PBS here.
It's British? Yeah, that's amazing. No, that is one of those series.
I think those are just so faithful.
They are.
In terms of adaptations. Almost to the point where they would almost be better TV episodes sometimes if they weren't so faithful. But they are extremely faithful. And I appreciate that.
Oh, and the thing is where they did break with canon, it actually adds to the characters.
Yes. And that
is important. Because, unfortunately, the problem with Arthur Conan Doyle is he wrote a bunch of stories. He thought, oh, okay. And then he killed off the character because he was done with it. And public reaction wasn't too positive. No one wanted to read his other stuff. And, yes, the Jeremy Brent series did a really great job of trying to fix all those little things to make them fit in and work with the characters the way the characters should be.
On comics and graphic novels, you're right, they're really – haven't been as many as you might think. One that I liked, again, it's more of a adaptation or pastiche, was called Baker Street, one of my favorites, a black and white book from the late 80s. 10 issues, more of a steampunk sort of vibe, took place in the punk era of sort of London of the 1980s. But Victorian fashions had never gone out of style, so it's a pretty cool mashup. And the Holmes and Watson analogs are pretty good. The mystery is pretty good. I enjoy that one. I've also picked up recently from the library some OGNs of some of the novels, the complete, like, 80-page comic adaptations of Study in Scarlet, Sign of Four, Baskervilles, those sorts of things. And those are pretty fun reads.
Oh, yeah. Like I said, the Eternity literally, I think, ran for like 40 issues. And mm-hmm. all they did was they were adapting. They weren't just doing a comic book version of it. It was actually still the prose in it.
Right.
With illustrations. So you can't get any closer to reading the actual book, but still reading a comic book at the same time.
Right. That's great. Most of the short stories are short enough that they can be turned into a reasonable length comic book series. As opposed to trying to do that to a, you know, humongous novel.
But there really wasn't any humongous Sherlock Holmes novels, were there?
No.
The longest one is Hounds of the Baskerville.
Right.
I'm not going to say you could cut out part of it, but there's a lot of going back and forth in it. It's like sort of a mid-70s Doctor Who episode.
I was going to say, it's a lot of running through corridors.
Yeah. Got to run across the moor this way, run across the moor that way.
Were you familiar with this specific title?
No, actually.
The last couple of years? Yeah, I had heard of it probably after the Kickstarter had closed. It was a Kickstarter book, and I was excited. I'm always up for a new context for Sherlock.
I mean, and you would think this would have been something that had been done before.
Right.
Going through and, you know, doing some history check, you know, they did Blackula, but they didn't do a Harlem Sherlock Holmes in the 70s. You know, I could see Sidney Poitier doing Sherlock Holmes.
Sure. Right. Right. This is as close as we've gotten. So let's take a break here, play a promo. And when we get back, it's issue one of Sadowski and Middle... Oh, Watson and Holmes.
It was a golden age. Our Martian civilization was at the height of its peace and prosperity.
White Martians came from beneath the planet's surface, bringing fire from the planet's guts, and they burned us all.
I lost my family. Came to Earth when my civilization was destroyed.
Detective John Jones is what you might call my human alter ego.
I'm not the only thing from outer space that's come, but right now I'm the only thing that can stop alien invasion.
My name is John Jones.
Also known as the Martian Manhunter.
I'm Mars' sole survivor. There's a reason for that.
I will defend Earth.
The Idle Head of Yabaloo. Podcast available through iTunes. Shout Engine and the Internet Archive.
And we're back. Watson and Holmes, number one, had a cover price of $2.99, meaning I acquired this book at just over a 91% discount. Thank you, Half Price Books. The issue had multiple covers, some of which are based on there being a second printing and the book starting life as a Kickstarter with, you know, various levels of rewards-based covers. But this is the main cover that Ron and I have. It's Rick Leonardi and Ryan Wardlow. And it's a black-and-white picture of our two heroes, modern-day African-American gentlemen, standing up against a brick wall, one of them holding a gun. So before we get too far, Ron, thoughts on the cover?
You know, looking at it, you really don't have any idea, do you?
Yeah. Other than the Watson and Holmes.
Yeah.
Logo across the top.
But I do have to say, it's a nice cover. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, I could not find a name for the story in the issue, but ComicBookDB lists this as, "No time for explanation, the game's afoot," which is a quote from the issue, of course. The story is written by Carl Bollers from a story by Paul Mendoza and Brandon Perlew, with great acknowledgments to the work of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. The art is by Rick Leonardi. The story starts with a baby crying in a dumpster. She's a Jane Doe and is rushed to Convent Emergency Center in Harlem, but they couldn't save her. Before John Watson can get too morose over that case, another one arrives, Sean Temple, a drug overdose who'd gotten his lights punched out. Uniformed police arrive, along with a man with the dreadlocks in a pretty good fashion sense. He asks Watson if he's the attending physician, which he's not, but says he'll talk, and he shows the other man his personal effects. The other man quickly announces that it was not a mugging, and Watson wants to know why he says that. Thieves would have stolen his wallet and phone. It's elementary. Temple awakens momentarily, but doesn't offer much useful information, except that they're holding someone he cares about, Trina. The men go their separate ways, finally introducing themselves to each other. It's a case of double mistaken identity, as they think the other one is a doctor or a police officer. But they're both wrong. John Watson, medical intern. He takes the other man's business card, which reads, S. Holmes, private investigator. Watson spends that night driving through the city, pondering, who was he? It was as much of a mystery as where Trina was. But I still spent all night looking. The next morning, Watson gets a lab report on Temple, and he was right. But how? He heads to Baker Street thinking that there's more to that brother than he thought. Before he can knock on the front door, though, Mrs. Hudson opens the door, assuming he must be the Dr. Watson that Mr. H. was expecting. I'm actually just a medical intern, ma'am. Holmes tries to talk Watson into telling him what's in the report, even though Holmes does not technically have any, you know, legal right to see it. So he just tells Watson what's in the report, and stunned, he confirms. Truth serum. They didn't want his phone or wallet. They wanted information. Watson and Holmes figure out the key to finding Trina is Junior. Following clues from the phone with the help of the irregulars, they learn that Junior was in the Suicidas gang. With the help of a pickpocketed cell phone, they track down Junior, but before they can intercept, he takes off. Holmes chases him down one street, and Watson intercepts him with a forearm shiver. Watson, I thought you were a doctor. Sometimes they need a good sedative. It turns out that Trina and Sean were kidnapped because they wanted Junior's drug connection. They tell Junior to set up a meet with the captors. Watson doesn't like the setup. Everything about these guys, their gear, their ride, screams former military, special ops. They talk about their motivations before Holmes sends a text, clearing a bunch of dudes away from the warehouse. Our title characters head in, kick down the door, find Trina tied to a chair with one gun-wielding, bad-looking dude guarding her. End of issue one. So, Ron, before we go into details, overall thoughts. We're not back to the bins. You don't have to grade it.
Yeah, but I don't want to be horrible. I just don't want to be that guy yet. It's a little slow in places. And there's two or three examples we'll get into where they use Holmesian referencing. But it really doesn't work as Holmesian referencing.
Mm-hmm. What specifically?
That it's elementary.
Yeah, yeah. That was a stretch.
But I would give it a pass because it's the first issue of a multi-issue series. They're setting things up. Yeah. They're just trying to get the story motivated. You get to know who the character. I mean, what if you're some kid? You go on the thing, Holmes, Watson, Holmes. This looks like a cool cop thing. And you're reading it. You have no idea who these guys are.
That's the nature of it being a Kickstarter, though.
Right.
That if you were, you know, supporting it and getting it directly that way, you obviously knew what you were getting. You know,
true.
You knew that you were getting a modernized Watson and Holmes in Harlem. But you're right, picking it up, you know, at random.
Like, say, Professor Allen does.
Exactly. You don't necessarily get that. No. That's fair.
I'm not a big modern comics reader for the simple fact that I don't like decompressed storytelling. I'm used to the Justice League going in and having six or seven incidences happen in 40 pages, you know?
The thing is, theoretically, with there have been mystery comics that have done one-issue-length stories. It's not out of the question. And the bulk of the official canon of Holmes stories are short stories. They're only four novels. And as we said, those novels aren't very long. It's 56 short stories. The scale tends to be pretty small. You know, you could do many of those as one or two issue stories. The nature of this, it is a four-part story. It is a modern comic book telling of this story.
And as a first act, it basically satisfies its criteria. Introduces the characters, sets up the scene, and now, you know, we'll get to the second act where the action and the drama mm-hmm. unfold.
We have Watson listed first on the title, Watson and Holmes. In general, what did he think of Watson, and then what did he think of Holmes?
I like the idea of Watson. It's just odd to say. but I was a little perplexed that he's an intern, because even if he had been a corpsman in the military or something like that, you'd think he'd be a little further along. You know, and I assume these are not young guys. I mean, I assume they're the late 20s, early 30s.
Right. Seems reasonable.
But that could be – I could be wrong. and I don't – the putting Watson first, I think it's because their point, this is always, it's going to be from Watson's point of view.
Right.
And if that's so, then that makes perfect sense. But no, they give it a little bit of background on – but I did find some things bothersome. You're a medical intern. You spend 12, 15 hours at the ER. Then you leave and you get in your car and drive around the city searching for someone.
Then you go back to work.
And then you go back to work.
When does this man sleep? Yeah, maybe, exactly. Maybe this is a super. Maybe this is a mutant story and we don't know it yet.
Exactly. This all fit in with the Deadpool connection.
You know, that was nice character building, you know, his commitment, his dedication. But yes, it did not, in the strictest technical sense, make sense. We do get the idea, though, and it is, I will spoil, I've read ahead a little bit. Holmes deduces accurately Watson is separated from his family and actually living out of his car. So he may have crashed for a couple of hours as he was driving around the city. He may have pulled into the garage at the hospital a couple hours early and gotten a little shut-eye then.
Then that's a good reason why the writer shows us that he basically doesn't go home, as he doesn't have a home to go to.
Right, which is why in either the second or third issue, they, of course, move in together to Baker Street.
Of course.
So Watson does have to be moderately homeless when they meet, right? I mean, that is part of the that is part of the shtick.
And again, you know, this is a first issue, and it's moving slowly. There's not any canon-esque references,
right,
to the first story that they meet in,
right? And I'm not sure what to make of that. You know, it's tricky because this is not an adaptation of any of the stories. You know, it is a new original story. We've mentioned the BBC, the Cumberbatch show, and that has done its Baskervilles. It's done its Study in Scarlet. It's done its Reichenbach. It's done its Scandal. You know, it's hit some of the major stories. You know, updated. You know, in their setting, in their context, this is just flat out a kidnapping and drug. This is just a gangland story. It's not part of the canon that's been adapted into a gangland story, or we don't get any of the Study in Scarlet introductory parts in this issue that are so common in first meetings of Watson and Holmes, whatever the adaptation is.
And I will point out that this Watson and Holmes storyline, and collected as a trade, is entitled A Study in Black.
That's probably the closest thing to a reference to the introductory story.
But, you know, again, you have to wonder, were they deliberately trying to avoid being too canon-esque? Did they have a story idea that they wanted to serve, and this is the best way to serve it? It's hard to tell. You know, if you're doing a story based on someone else's character who has a history, you may want to give something for those people who are coming because of the character.
Yeah, and all you get really in the first issue is shout-outs.
Yeah.
You get a reference to the Irregulars. You do get him living with Mrs. Hudson. You know, you get just a few things like that, but nothing of a story nature.
And I'll have to point out, Holmes is a complete enigma. They don't give him anything here. Mm-hmm. They give him, I think, two chances to make a Holmesian-type deduction, and really only one chance to explain one. So.
Right.
Outside of that, you really get nothing on his personality. Or
one of the things I like that, again, that comes up in some of the later issues is that you learn how deficient he is in some areas, which is a great Holmes character trait that sometimes is skipped over. He does not have much knowledge of sort of pop culture type things. They're pop culture references that go over his head. And, you know, classically, you know, Watson is amazed at the extent of his knowledge in some areas and amazed at his complete lack of knowledge and lack of interest in other areas. So they tease at that a little bit, but you don't get that here. I always think that's when that's done, I think that's an interesting. I think Doyle nailed something really interesting and unique there. And when that's picked up, and it's not always. In adaptation, yeah. Sometimes he's too much of a superhuman, you know, super brain.
No, the original Sherlock Holmes was a file catalog of certain things, and other things he just didn't care about.
Exactly. So they touch on that a little bit here, which I like. But
even the Holmesian deductions, not terribly deep.
Right.
He doesn't look at anyone's shoe and tell you go, ah, he was at the old concrete plant.
Right. You know. He does pin Watson in terms of what exactly he did in Afghanistan. Yeah, we don't have the explanation yet. But he says something about you can opt out now, doctor. I do love that everyone calls him doctor, even though he's not. You can opt out now if you want, doctor. This is a far cry from being a pararescue man in Afghanistan. What? How did? Oh, yeah, whatever. We're just going to run in and beat these guys up. But I do like that Watson is the muscle.
Well, he always was.
Right.
He always was. He was the guy with the gun.
Yep. Yep. That's when they always said, do you have your sidearm available, Watson? You knew. You knew things were getting real when Holmes asked that question.
No, the funny thing is Holmes had a pistol himself because he did target practice at the house. But he never took it with him. He always made Watson do it. I think the concept was, you know, if, you know, we get in real trouble, you pull out a gun, they'll shoot at you. I can get away.
Right.
He wasn't a fool. Remember, you don't have to be able to outrun the bear. You just have to be able to outrun your partner.
Exactly. What did you think of the art here? It's a pretty sedate color palette.
It looks like it's a black and white with just a touch of color.
Yeah, on most pages it does have that look of it.
I mean, I like it, and hopefully it works in the rest of the story. But I wasn't sure if they were going for not a romanticized, but a you know, hazy Harlem that, you know, it could be the 30s, it could be the 90s, it could be 2010, or if they, you know, it was supposed to be sort of bleached out because it's, you know, it's the city, the sun,
right.
And the harsh life. Not exactly sure where they're going with it. It looks nice. Mm-hmm. I would not mind seeing more like this.
Mm-hmm. One thing, like you said, on the in terms of the traditional Holmes, you'd have to figure out a modern way to do this, I guess. But you know, I love when Holmes disguises. Holmes is master of disguise, and you don't get any of that in this series at all. And again, I don't know how you would do that. Oh, cosplay. I mean, I didn't know what the modern equivalent would be. I mean, having access to the Harlem Theater District would seem, you know, viable. You know, possibly you could have some access to costumes or whatever. But they don't go that direction. And that's always one of my favorite Holmesian bits that I certainly think was missed here.
And truth is in the canon, you don't get it until about 3 or 4 stories in that he starts doing that.
The other thing. You don't get all of the aspects that you think of, you know, the checklist in every story.
But the irregulars worked very well. That was a perfect item to use. Street kids are going to be your best way of getting information.
Your best source, right.
Right. Now, if they go too crazy with it, and they have in some adaptations where these kids are everywhere and they know everything.
Right.
You know. In this regard, knowing where the floating rave is,
right,
and who contacted and stuff, that mm-hmm. that fit right in with what you're trying to get here. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing. Not only are you doing an adaptation of Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, what you're doing is you're doing a story about a place. This is Harlem in New York,
right,
and as a going concern, most of us have never been there. So what you have to give us visual cues. You have to give us story cues about what this Harlem is like. I think maybe that's the weakest part of this. Is this could be in Harlem. This could be in Baltimore. This could be in Birmingham, England, for all I know.
Right.
I
mean, this is generic big city.
Right. They don't say, hey, I'm going to meet my regulars in so-and-so park, or, you know, there's no sense of place.
That's a good point.
And sometimes, like with stories like this, you have to admit, you know, with the Holmes canon, London is part of the story.
Oh, yes, yes.
And when he leaves London, it's always, that's when you go to something and do something weird.
Right.
That's where you have devil dogs on moors and vampires in Sussex. You know, you get out of London. Yeah, he's comfortable in London. London is his home. But, you know, I mean, Baker Street, you know, it's a street in some city. There's a lot of places in Harlem. The fact that Holmes happens to know who Junior is, what gang he's running with, the gang leader who he basically muscles and steals his phone. Again, you get sort of it's a little bit too small. And again, what's the mystery? I mean, and sometimes you have to ask this, is this a Holmesian mystery?
Right.
Would Sherlock Holmes really have taken this case? Maybe, maybe not. I haven't read the rest of the story. I have to read the rest of the story to answer that question. If someone had just read the rest of that story.
It's a pretty standard drug kingpin muscling in type of story. So in that sense, there's nothing weird, unusual, inherently interesting to it, you know, which were always the things that, as you're getting at, that jumped off the newspaper to Holmes. With the exception of, you know, we've got a baby dead in a dumpster at the beginning, and, you know, someone we know who's been kidnapped, you know, sort of maybe adding to that mystery. But there is sort of the feel of, it's just another drug case in Harlem. As Holmes would say, what's singular about it? And that's not answered here yet.
Yeah, and then how did, you know, and again, how does Junior reach out to Holmes? Because he called Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
This time it's personal. again, we don't get these things. If it was someone that Holmes knew, you sort of feel that he would have said something that, you know, yeah, this was one of my former regular guys, or
mm-hmm.
or some, you know, this is a personal favor for his mom or something. You know, you don't get anything like that, and hopefully in the story it becomes I don't want to say important, but it materializes and makes it solid. But as by itself, it's a basic introduction to some characters in a place.
And and for me, I ask myself, would I be reading this story if it was called Sadowski and Middleton?
Oh yeah, you would.
Okay, if it were called I don't know, Rifen and Doak. I mean, if it were called
else. No. You don't want, because all of you Rifen saying stupid things and then Doak going, yeah, you're right.
Yeah. What I'm saying is, if it weren't called Watson and Holmes.
Exactly. If this was called
something else.
Yeah.
A kidnapping in Harlem.
Exactly.
Would I be rushing in to read
it? But you have paid the whole 25 cents.
Exactly.
A kidnapping Harlem for 25? I don't know. But they saw you coming. They knew exactly how to get that quarter out of you.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's one thing I think you have to ask, because it's an expectation. You put a certain person's name on there, and it is an expectation of something better than just an average story.
Right. That's fair. Well, it comes down to this. The verdict on Watson and Holmes number one. Ron, do you owe me a quarter for this? No, I mean, would it hypothetically have been worth a quarter?
You know, because I know who I am, if there was the three or four issues in the bins and I could get them all for a quarter each, I'd have paid $1 for this.
Yeah.
But, you know, this would infuriate me, because I'd read this, and even though I may not have terribly been impressed with it, I've got a hanging storyline. I got to know what happens. Don't do this to me.
You know, I enjoyed it. Again, I am probably bringing Watson and Holmes expectations, both positive and negative, to that. There are things I'm not getting because of what I want from a Watson and Holmes story. There are things I'm probably reading into it and elevating, you know, because of my appreciation for the character. So, of course, almost every comic's worth a quarter. So, a quarter bin deal. The biggest drawback, though, is sort of what Ron's getting at. It is a decompressed story, and it is part of a longer story. So that's a legitimate quibble. The series overall, by the way, was an Eisner Award nominee for Best New Series. So sometimes me and the comic book critics don't always seem eye to eye, but at least the story taken as a whole was considered to be pretty good. So Ron, thank you so much for joining me on this one. I will say, When I saw it in the cheap bin, I immediately had two thoughts. One, I definitely need to do this on the show. And two, I need to talk about it with Sadowski.
Well, I appreciate it. And the only complaint I have about your show, more randomness. You know, I like my randomness in my comics.
Well, if I had put this in the database and waited for it to come up, we would both be much older gentlemen by the time we finally would have gotten around to it, perhaps. So, true. I'm sorry.
Yes, violate your own rules.
So, Mr. Sadowski, tell us where on the internet you can be found, unless you don't want to be found, I guess, based on your known associates. Ooh, might not.
I do a little show with some other guys occasionally called Dinner for Geeks on the Two True Freaks Network. Dinner for, the number four, Geeks. Take you to Two True Freaks or iTunes or wherever you want to find it.
And based on what I can tell on the schedule, the turnaround time, that by the time the next time you and the guys meet, you know, later this week, and you talk to them about, hey, you know, talk to Professor Allen, Quarter Bin's going to be coming out soon. That episode will probably be out in mid-2017, 2018, or...
Actually, we're going to save it probably to be our 200th episode, which will be sometime to turn in the next century.
Yeah, there's a rumor that Mr. Scott Rifen has 30-some episodes on his hard drive somewhere.
Yeah.
Is that approximate, like that, do you think?
Well, the thing is even though we have not released an episode for like 3 months, we were still having dinner every week.
Exactly. So he's releasing them now just because he has to clear space on his computer? Is that
I think that's it. Yeah, he just got tired of having to push them to one side.
That was the motivator.
He needs more space for his Star Wars stuff.
Yeah, I tell you. Priorities. Yeah.
Can't explain it to some kids.
Well, Ron, thanks again for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Professor.
That wraps up my coverage of Watson and Holmes number one, but it does not bring this episode to a close. I'm going to play a promo, come back all by myself, sorry, Ron, and talk a little bit more about Watson and Holmes.
In fact, I think we should record a promo about all the changes to the Fire and Water Podcast Network happening this year. What do you think, Rob?
That's a great idea. We can mention the new folks joining the network and all the shows. I can talk about how we'll continue with our Aquaman and Firestorm show, and I want to be sure to plug my movie show, the Film and Water Podcast. What about you, Ryan?
Oh, I think we should definitely record a promo. I'll mention how the Secret Origins podcast is joining the Fire and Water Network, and then I'll introduce my newly relaunched shows, Give Me Those Star Wars and Power of Fishnets, the Black Canary and Zatanna podcast. Sound good to you, Chris?
Absolutely. I'll mention the show I record with my lovely wife, Cindy, Supermates, the Husband and Wife Geekcast. We should probably also mention the Power Records podcast Rob and I do, too. What about you, Siskoid?
Well, sure. I can talk about my ensemble show, the Lonely Hearts Romance Comics podcast, and my new upcoming shows about the DC Comics crossover event, Invasion, and yes, Oh Hot Moo. Shag, you think we should mention Hero Points, the most occasional DC Heroes role-playing podcast?
Sure, why not? And I can talk about Who's Who, the definitive podcast of the DC Universe, and mention my new upcoming show, Justice League International, Wahaha podcast. Now, here's what I'm thinking. When we record, I'm fine being the first person talking. I can explain all the changes to the
Wait a minute. Why do you get to start the promo? I'm just as much of a part of this as you are. It was my idea to create the Fire and Water podcast back in 2011. I should start off this promo.
I kind of think it should be one of the new voices who kick off the promo. It'll shock the listener into attention if it's not Rob or Shag.
Cindy and I make up two people in the network, plus, you know, ladies first, so we should be the first people talking on the promo.
Ben voyons donc.
You have what? God.
Enough! Stop it. You're like boys with toys. Let's just make this simple. We can tell the folks at home the Fire and Water Podcast Network is growing in 2016. Several new shows are joining the network. We'll have a new dedicated website, a Twitter account, and Facebook page, and folks will be able to subscribe to each individual show or all of them. See, now was that so hard?
The Fire and Water Podcast Network, available soon through iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Seriously, Shag, you had to get the last word, didn't you?
And we're back. Actually, just I'm back. When I read issue 1 to prep for this episode, I posted that fact on my Eyes and Ears blog. And great listener and Kansan, Greg Arujo, pointed out that he had read the trade from his public library. Now, since this was a Kickstarter project, it never crossed my mind that the trade would have been sold publicly and that my library would ever have a chance to get it. But I checked, and there it was. Ron and I talked about this a little bit, but since this is a mystery, you only do get the beginning of the action in issue 1, so I'm going to do a brief run-through of the rest of the trade just to let you know what the mystery is and how the baby in the dumpster ties in. In issue 2, they rescue Trina and chase the gunman onto the street before losing him. At the hospital, John calls his wife, who already considers herself his ex-wife. Holmes meets his high-tech expert to get to the encrypted data on the first victim's phone, which reveals 3 names. One is already dead, and they head to his apartment, running across Lieutenant Leslie Stroud. She lets Holmes observe the scene, filling her in on anything she may have missed, including that the man's laptop had been boosted. On his way out, Holmes snags the dead man's keys, and they find his laptop in a gym club locker. The laptop is set to receive a live video feed of the second man on the list, but he's just been killed by one of the men who kidnapped Trina. In issue 3, Watson and Holmes take a limo to the Diogenes Club to have lunch with Holmes' big brother, Mike. They conclude that the man who was holding Trina was working for Griffin, a big defense contractor that Watson knew of in Afghanistan. Mycroft also was able to identify the last man on the hit list as a Reverend Rice, a local pastor, but his nuns haven't seen him in a week. Holmes thinks he might just be Junior's coke connection. They realize that they're being tailed across the city. They do track down Junior to soup kitchen, and he leads them to the Reverend, and have a conversation with him, with Lieutenant Stroud listening in. The Reverend justified his actions by using some of the proceeds to fund the soup kitchen and do other good works. But the Reverend is a marked man, and before the police show up, the bad guys do. In issue 4, the trio escape to the roof, and the Reverend basically gives himself up, taking a sniper round right through the forehead. Watson and Holmes brief the police, then head for the Reverend's mailbox. Holmes has swiped his keys as well, and finds the man's laptop. But he has to leave it for the bad guys, or they will kill Watson, who they have in their scopes. They reconvene with Lieutenant Stroud, who tells them that her transport van was intercepted, and the hitmen are free. Watson uses his access to the hospital records to track down Junior's address, and he'd been slipped a hard drive by the late Reverend. They deduce the password, and we learn that Holmes has some programming chops. The drug distribution info is all there, the case is wrapped up, and Watson takes up residence as Holmes' roommate. In issue 5, the last issue in the trade, we return to the case of the kidnapped babies that started off the whole adventure, which in comic time was only about 3 days ago. The baby that died in issue 1 was the 6th similar case over the past few months, although the others had all survived. They talk to the mother of the baby, which leads them to a Dr. Reed from a prenatal clinic, who they suspect of stealing the babies, but the police lineup is a total disaster, and suspicion then falls on a midwife, but the real culprit is a crusading journalist who wanted to bring attention to the terrible conditions among young, underprivileged girls. But his stories kept getting buried in the back of the paper. He didn't make the front page until he himself was arrested. Okay, some quick thoughts on the rest of the trade. Like I said to Ron, this is, at its core, simply a case of drugs and gangs and inner-city violence, with the case itself presenting very little that's particularly Holmesian. In terms of Holmesian aspects, we do get some deductions, including some callbacks to the first issue. Holmes explains how he knows so much about Watson's military career based on the unit logo on his coffee mug. We also see him working with the police, really getting the respect of the police, getting the run of a crime scene for a little bit. but the setting and the characters do become a little more Holmesian as the story goes by, especially the scene with Mycroft. We have the irregulars come back, and of course we end with our heroes becoming roomies. So you have that key plot element from A Study in Scarlet, even though the story itself is not related to any of the traditional Conan Doyle library. The plot elements that are the exception might be the paramilitary stuff, the government contractor stuff. I imagine that that's there as part of the ongoing storyline intended to come back in the future. And if Mycroft is involved, and if this goes to the highest level of governments, then that could lift this beyond the standard mystery tale. In that scene at the Diogenes Club, Mycroft points out that the Reverend's alias was a reference to the movie New Jack City, which Sherlock has never heard of. A reference later by Watson to the Harlem Shake also goes over his head. And I like that his weakness is pop culture. I also liked the subtlety of him being a computer programmer, but needing a specialist to crack encryption. Because we read comic books. We know that in comics, if you're a scientist, you're a scientist of everything. Or if you're a doctor, you're a doctor of everything. But Holmes has never been portrayed as a generalist. He is a deep-diving specialist in certain very specific areas. And coding and hacking are not the same things. But in a standard comic book, that distinction would be totally glossed over. So I think that key aspect of Holmes' character was really captured well here. But the key to the story, what works for me, why I like this a good amount, is the relationship between the leads. Like I said, this takes place over a compressed period of time. And in that time, we see their understanding of each other grow, their trust in each other grow, their reliance on each other, and their friendship. All that I liked. I think the lesson is that if you give me two characters, one named Watson, one named Holmes, and you have them relate to each other with some humor and good friendship and tell a decent mystery, I guess I'm just a total sucker for that. From what I can tell, only one more actual comic issue came out after this one, and it had a totally different creative team. But then again, I saw a second trade solicited that contained that other issue, number 6, but also advertised two stories with modern takes on classic Holmes stories. So it seems that after introducing their new comic with an original inner-city type crime drama, they are leaning back in to the particular Holmes canon and doing their take on that. So maybe they've switched over to a totally original graphic novel format. I can't quite tell. I also saw that the series has been optioned for a movie, but no further info on that is available. In a part of the conversation with Ron that did not make the final cut, he did opine that this comic seemed more like a screenplay to him than it did a comic book. He wondered if the comic was the backup plan after not getting any nibbles on a screenplay. And there is the odd case of the men credited as the creators of Watson Holmes not actually being the writers or artists on the comic. The hypothesis was that Brandon Perlow and Paul Mendoza had written a script of some kind and, unable to sell it, brought in Carl Ballers to write the comic version with Rick Leonardi penciling. One of the creators is listed as the publisher. He founded New Paradigm Press. The other did colors on the first 3 issues. So they were involved, but they don't appear to be traditional comic book dudes, which is why it's cool that they produced a pretty good comic book, an award-winning comic book at that. But like I said, it did just seem like a weird setup, and I think Ron's idea makes a lot of sense, that this is really the movie pitch that we're reading in comic book form. And again, if that was the goal, to get a script bought, that seems to have worked. Again, at least the comic version of the characters have been optioned. And if that movie ever gets made, and if it looks halfway decent, you know I'll be there. That wraps up my coverage, finally, of Watson and Holmes number 1 and 2, 3, 4, and 5, sort of, bringing episode 70 of the Quarterbin podcast to a close. In episode 71, as Ron Sadowski requested, it's a random selection next time. We'll be dialing up Adventure Comics 479 from DC, cover dated March 1981. If you have any questions or comments about this issue, the episode, or the podcast as a whole, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the Quarterbin.
The Quarterbin podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening.
If I was doing it, one of my pet peeves is when they do a Sherlock Holmes story and they use a name or adaptation of one of the titles and it has nothing to do with that story. It drives me up the wall.
Right.
The Study in Black. And I'm like, okay, there wasn't someone traveling from out of town. There wasn't any Mormons in this.
They do meet and move in together. So that I think that's – but yes.
If that's the only takeaway you get from that story. But I thought it would probably be a better story. The one where Watson's asked by his wife's friend to go and get her husband out of the opium den. And he's in there getting him, he runs into Holmes.
Right.
And he thinks Holmes has fallen off the wagon.
Right.
That would have been a great way to start this. Mm-hmm. You don't really have to have the first thing be they meet.
Right.
Go into it, have them already together, and then we do flashbacks. It felt a little linear.
It's comic books. You can always do episode zero whenever you want to. Well, and then tell the origin.
No, I really do appreciate it. You guys do a great show. You do a great show. Right. And you two together do a good show.
Good. Good.
And I always enjoy it. There's always something new and interesting to hear.
There you go.
So I'm you're a lot nicer than I am. So.
Well, okay, we'll find out right here.
Yeah.
We've got to compare and contrast. The way I'm listening to these Dinner for Geeks. So basically, you and Scott will talk about being on the show, and listeners will hear that in about a year and a half. Is that about?
Or next week. I never know.
That's right, Scott. Either one. Yeah.
It was something. I'm like, did we even record that one yet? And he goes, oh yeah, I just had to get it out quick. I thought it was imperative. I'm like, why?
I mean, there's not a lot of breaking news on those. I mean, I'm just saying. I'm not judging. I'm just saying.
The funny thing is we just this is what we always did. We always wouldn't go and have dinner.
Yeah.
And so once a week we would have dinner. And then someone had the bright idea to record it.
And here we are.
Yeah. Now I'm a prisoner of my own fame.
That's what they're calling it, huh?
Okay, yeah.
Okay. You ready to do this?
Sure. Let the crash and burn begin.
Exactly. I can edit almost everything. By the time we're done, it'll just be me a solo episode. Is that what you're saying?
It end up like a what's shag, you know, drop in there. It's like, exactly. She's hot. You have Ron's drop in, which is like, huh?
La,
huh?
This is where we edit.
This is where we edit.
You're going to sound so good.
No, I'm not. I'm always going to sound like me. huh?